702.
Africa at a glance.
John Mugum Mbaku is my guest this evening. He's economics professor at Weber State University in the United States. John, thank you so much, Prof, for agreeing to talk to us this evening.
Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you very much.
It is just above a year now since the eruption of the war in Sudan. I think it broke out on the 15th of April last year. Can we talk about, perhaps, just to put my listeners into the picture, as to who are the players, why did the war start, what is the context?
Well, one way to look at it is to say that Sudan has had a lot of problems with governance. Since it gained independence in 1956, it has not been able to have a stable government. The military has constantly interfered with governance. And so the country, over the years, has not been able to establish strong and sustainable governance institutions. And as a result, the military has continued to interfere in governance. And what has happened is that Sudan was ruled by al-Bashir for over 30 years, al-Bashir himself being a military person and came into power through the military. And in 2019, there was a revolution. And the hope was that the revolution would provide an opportunity for Sudanese to come together and finally construct institutions that will allow them to have a democratic process through which they could govern their own country. And unfortunately, that didn't work. Because these two generals ended up, al-Burhan and Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo from the Rapid Support Forces and Burhan from the Sudan Armed Forces, they were the two people who were basically controlling the country and were supposed to prepare the country for transition to democracy. They had a falling out, and the falling out over who really was supposed to lead the country. And that has resulted in a situation where we have what is now literally a civil war, and that's where we are now. And the two of them are not willing to agree on the way forward, and they've continued to fight, and they've destroyed virtually most of the infrastructure in Khartoum and in other parts of the country. And as a result, the country is now a basket case in terms of the fact that more than 18 million people in the country are facing acute food insecurity. 14 million of them are children and women. And over 70% of the hospitals are no longer functional. And there's been a significant rise in infectious diseases. And so what is happening in the country right now is that, to answer your question, the political ambitions of these two individuals combined with problems, misgovernance that has occurred for many years has put the country where it is today.
In the days, I suppose, preceding, maybe say the years preceding the 2019 uprising against Omar al-Bashir, we had already been hearing of, shall I say, even genocidal sort of attacks on a certain Sudanese settlements by groups such as the Janjaweed Tigers and all sorts of organizations. We had heard of the religious conflicts that came from those who was characterized by those who were pushing an Islamist sort of way of life versus perhaps the African spiritual worldview that was taking place in Sudan. What are the issues that have then exacerbated the tensions that we now see in Sudan now?
Well, what has happened is that this conflict, as most conflicts in Sudan usually happen, there's a religious angle to it. In addition to the religious angle, there is this argument in Sudan that certain people belong to Sudan and certain others don't. And that problem has had something to do with this myth among some Sudanese groups that they are Arabs or descendants of Arabs. And as a result, they deserve to be in power in Sudan, much more so than, say, people who are more African than Arab. And so one of the problems in Darfur, for example, the ethnic cleansing that you've seen in Darfur has had to do with the struggle between various groups in Darfur and the Janjaweed, many of whom claim that they are descendants of Arabs and that they are superior to the Africans. And so that, in addition to the fact that over the years, Khartoum has used these militias like the Janjaweed to fight its wars for them, that has created a situation in which it's very difficult to understand what is actually going on in the country at the moment. Because most people who are analyzing Sudan often come to realize that it is not just a fight between the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces, because there are other groups that are involved within the process, and the chaos created by this civil war has allowed those other groups, like the Janjaweed, for example, and other so-called Arab groups to come up and commit crimes against humanity that have driven a very large number of people into neighboring countries and created a humanitarian crisis that is the international community has not yet been able to understand fully. So the situation is very complex. And the only way forward is to provide a governance a system that allows all these groups in Sudan to live together peacefully. There's no reason why Sudanese should continue to fight each other, because they are not the only country in Africa that has a lot of groups, either groups that are defined by religion or defined by ethnicity or defined by ancestry. They are not the only country in Africa to have that. As a result of colonialism and migration, most African countries have groups that have groups that are made up of different configurations, ethnicity, religion, and so on and so on. Those groups can live together peacefully, as we see groups living in other parts of the world peacefully, if the country is able to have appropriate governance institutions. This thing in Sudan, when the military continues to interfere with governance, is creating a situation in which it is very difficult for groups to live together peacefully, because those groups are then forced to join militias, to join military groups that allow them to survive, and those groups become opportunistic and end up destroying opportunities for other groups to function.
I suppose at some point we might have to speak about a two-state system in Sudan, given the fact that we've had in Sudan what some people have called ethnic cleansing, sometimes genocide. These words have become very popular over the last few months. I suppose as a result of what is happening in Gaza and the conflicts that are taking place there.
It's a good point. But what we have to keep in mind is that the southern regions of Sudan split away from Sudan in 2011 for several reasons, but some of the reasons are the reasons we are discussing now. Basically, they argued, the country that is now South Sudan, the groups that left argued that they could no longer live with Khartoum, they could no longer live with the northern part of Sudan simply because of religious persecution, religious and ethnic persecution. And so they left and formed South Sudan. But as we can see, or as we are seeing, is that South Sudan has not been able to govern itself properly, because once they left Sudan for religious and ethnic reasons, they themselves started fighting amongst themselves.
Yes.
Over ethnicity. The Nuer, for example, and the Dinka started fighting against each other to determine who should rule the country. And so one of the things that those of us who study this, who study Africa, come to understand is that the issue is having to establish governance institutions. The issue is not to continue to split these countries into smaller and smaller administrative regions or entities. The issue is to make sure that we have institutions that can allow groups to live together peacefully, and not be and allow each group to be able to pursue its own values, to pursue its own interests, without interfering with the ability of other groups to pursue their own interests. I mean, I don't think that if South Africa, for example, starts having governance problems, I don't think it would be a good solution to say, okay, let's split the country and create individual nations, because that is not going to solve the problem. As soon as you do that, other reasons will come up.
Sure.
For these groups to continue to fight each other. So I think the emphasis should be on governance. The emphasis should be on creating governance institutions that allow groups to live together peacefully, pursue their own interests for development.
I concur and agree with the vision that you put forward as a subject. I mean, as a solution for any country that has issues of diversity and cultural diversity, ethnic diversity. I absolutely agree with you. I think that if people can sit around a table and calm heads can prevail, the issues should be how do we work together to make this country functional, right? But there's always stuff. I mean, you make an example of South Africa now. There are people in the Western Cape that are talking about cessation of that province in South Africa from South Africa. In KwaZulu-Natal, there are some people that are also talking in those terms to say that perhaps it's time to think about a cessation of KwaZulu-Natal from the rest of South Africa. So I mention this because as much as it is not the desirable thing for most countries, it has been part of the talk, of the discourse, particularly in one of the most infamous conflicts that we have in the world at the moment, what's happening in Gaza with regards to the Israeli forces ravaging that part of the world. My question to you, Prof, is, are we seeing here a situation of the age-old African story of unresolved issues coming from the colonial era? And I want to say this. I want to say that, you know, many of the issues that you find on the African continent in the various countries that make up the continent are aftertastes, unresolved issues that come from the colonial era and the inability of the leaders of those countries to effectively deal with those issues. Is that what we are seeing in Sudan?
Yes, you are right. The thing is that you sometimes, to understand some of these problems, you have to understand the purposes of colonialism. Over the years, the Europeans have tried to rewrite colonial history to make colonialism appear as some form of benevolence, some form of a process in which they were trying to quote, civilized Africans, in order to make themselves good, feel good about colonialism. But if you study colonialism very carefully, one of the things you discover was that colonialism was not about civilization. Colonialism was simply a process in which the Europeans came to Africa in an attempt to divide Africa, sow seeds of destruction within the continent in order to plunder the continent for the benefit of their own economy, so-called metropolitan economies. And so many of the institutions that the Europeans brought to Africa were not designed to govern the people. And in most cases, the institutions were designed to scatter the people, make them hate each other. And one of the things that was done was to elevate some groups and make them, as you saw with the Germans in what is now Burundi and Rwanda. And after the Germans left, of course, the Belgians came in. The idea was to elevate some group. And sometimes you could even create those groups artificially and elevate them, make them feel superior to the other people within the territory. And so what you are seeing in Sudan today is the same idea that some groups feel superior to others and believe that it is they were born to rule, they were born to be the rulers of the country, and that other groups were supposed to be subservient to them. And so some of this struggle has to do with that particular idea. So some of the problem that the colonialists brought, unfortunately, after independence, African countries did not sit together, and Sudan is one of them. They did not sit together and revisit their history and try to figure out how to live together peacefully. They simply adopted processes that were left behind by the Europeans. And so some groups went on to dominate the economy, to dominate the political system. And so this is the problem we are seeing today, because many of those groups no longer want to even envision themselves as being out of power. And so when you start talking about participatory governance, inclusive governance, that way of looking at things is alien to those people. And so when you say let's establish a democratic system in which every citizen has an opportunity to participate, those people don't like that idea, because they believe that it is in their best interest to continue to rule. And so your suggestion about this idea of splitting Sudan is quite attractive to some people, because there are analysts who believe that the operation of people in Sudan has been so thorough that some people are no longer interested in listening. These are the oppressed people. Many of them are no longer interested in listening to any idea of peaceful coexistence. They are telling themselves, we can no longer trust these people who have oppressed us for so long to be willing to talk to us. We can no longer trust that if we have a government that is democratic, they will not soon reverse course and begin to oppress us as they've done before.
I raise the issue of the two-state solution because it's already happening in Sudan. Yeah. The breakaway of South Sudan from the rest of Sudan is in many ways a manifestation of that very kind of thinking of, and as you pointed out, that when people break away, they themselves start to fight over the resources of that country, and they also jostle for power. So I get that. I want to go a little bit further back with regards to Sudan and, of course, the tensions between those who see themselves as descendants of Arabs and those who consider themselves indigenous. To what extent is the conversation in Sudan also about the unresolved issue of Arabic colonization of North northern parts of the African continent. You know, we have very robust conversations about the colonialism of Europe, but there seems to be a conversation about the colonization of Africa by Arab states, Arab powers. We talk about the Christianization of European colonialism, but very, very seldom do we talk about the Islamification of African colonies by Arabian forces. To what extent is that aspect playing itself out in Sudan?
I think that aspect has a more significant impact on today's Sudan than, say, European, say, British colonialism. You remember that when Sudan gained independence in 1956, it gained independence from the Anglo-Egyptian. It was called Anglo-Egyptian Sudan at the time, because at that time, Egypt, or rather Britain, was ruling Sudan through Egypt. And so Egypt had a very significant impact on what was happening in Sudan. And in addition to the fact that the Arabs colonized most of North Africa, when it comes to Sudan, you have to keep in mind that in addition to the religion, the Islamic religion that was brought to Sudan by those people, they also settled in that part of the world. Except for South Africa, maybe Zimbabwe, and to a certain extent, some pockets of Zambia and Malawi. What happened in many other African countries was that large groups of Europeans did not stay behind, as opposed to the Arabs who stayed behind in Sudan and actually had descendants who now claim to be the holders of power in the country. And so you have this problem where even though we can say European colonialism did have some impact on Sudan, I believe that the introduction of the Islamic religion and the fact that Arabs ended up remaining in Sudan and becoming part of the population and creating a situation in which those descendants of Arabs now consider themselves superior to the indigenous population is probably one of the most important influences in what is going on in Sudan today, because there is significant discrimination between people who claim to be descendants of Arabs, who are usually identified by their lighter skin, and the indigenous people in Sudan who are being marginalized significantly politically and economically. In Darfur, for example, there's been significant levels of mass killings going on, primarily of people who are members of indigenous groups. And so this is the situation that you have there today. And I think that, introduction of Arab colonialism does have a significant impact on what is going on in the country today.
Talk to me about let me give you another analysis and help me if I'm too far off the mark. All of these issues, the race issues, the ethnic issues, the religious issues, because I have it on good authority that there are those people who say, listen, we're not Muslim. We are African. We don't subscribe to the Muslim religion as part of their issue in these conflicts. That is also a big issue that is under the radar, as it were, whenever we talk about these conflicts. Talk to me about how all of those issues, whether it's ethnic issues, race issues, religious issues, are vehicles really for an economic battle? What resources, economic resources, is Sudan pregnant of that these issues assist? But actually, maybe we need to look at more fundamental issues of resources, of minerals, of whatever is the inheritance, the heritage of Sudan. What does Sudan have?
Well, Sudan has a lot of natural resources. Although most of the oil in Sudan is located in South Sudan, Sudan does have a lot of natural resources, including, for example, gold. And many countries, for example, the UAE, the Russian Federation, those countries are interested in Sudan because they want to exploit those natural resources. Now, there are other natural resources in Sudan that have not yet been discovered. Sudan is a very big country, actually the third largest country in Africa. And one of the problems that we have, not just in Sudan, but all over the world, is that sometimes traits like ethnicity, language, and religion are often used as proxies for political an economic organization. In other words, when a group of people are trying to capture political power, especially in a poor country like Sudan, they may use religion and ancestry as a way to identify themselves and capture votes if there is an election. Or if there's not an election, develop the military power to be able to threaten the government and have a say in what is happening in the country. And I think this is what is going on in Sudan, because if you look at the militias that have propped up in Sudan to either support the government or fight against the government, one of the things you see is that many of them are ethno-religious groups. So like the Janjaweed, for example,
yeah,
who are made up of Arab ethnic groups. Now, it's very difficult to talk in terms of Arab ethnic groups in Sudan, primarily because there are no pure Arabs in Sudan that I know of. But these are individuals who identify themselves as Arabs because of the way they look. And so in terms of the struggle for resources, the struggle for economic resources, many of these groups emerge as vehicles that are used to struggle for resources. So the existence of this group per se is not a problem. It is the fact that many of them become militarized and used as vehicles to maximize the interest of their leaders and those people who are leading or individuals who are leading those groups. So you can see that the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces in Sudan, have significant support from various Arab militias within the country. And you can ask yourself, why are they doing that? They are doing that because if the ISF succeeds in capturing the government of Sudan and becomes the rulers, then these groups will be able to benefit economically.
Mm.
And so if you're looking at the long-term vision, is for these groups to have an opportunity to be in a position in which they can benefit economically. So the fight for power is not for power in itself, but power as a way to have access to the resources, to have access to the foreign aid that is being sent to the country, to have access to other resources that come in, oil, for example, gold, and other natural resources. This is all part of the struggle that you have going on in the country today. Just as it was during the colonial period, the price is the economy.
Yeah. Because I suppose we can have conversations about race, ethnic group, I mean, ethnicity and religion. But most of the time I've come to understand that actually all of these things are about the great honeypot of the economic sort of resources of that particular country. It doesn't matter where you are. It usually comes down to that. Now we have two armies that are fighting each other. It is, of course, the RSF and the SAF. Which interests, broadly speaking, do these forces actually represent?
Well, if you talk to the groups, I mean, the two groups, the two parties.
Yeah.
If you talk to the rapid support forces.
Yeah.
If you talk to them, they'll tell you that they want to liberate the country from the tyranny of the Sudan Armed Forces. That's what they'll tell you. That the reason they're fighting is to liberate Sudan from tyranny.
But they worked together. They worked together for a significant amount of time after 2019.
Yeah, the thing was the RSF. Remember, his middle name is Support. RSF was supposed to be a rapid support force, a force that could be put out, you know, like the Marines, where there was a major problem, like what was happening in Darfur. If there's a major problem and you need rapid, some kind of rapid mobilization, they will come into effect and do that job. So they were supposed to support the Sudanese armed forces. But the problem is that the leaders of this group became opportunistic and started fighting the very people that they were supposed to be working with. And so when you look at them, and you can ask yourself, why are they fighting? What exactly are they trying to do? What they are trying to do is maximize certain objectives, but those objectives are aligned with the leaders of the two groups, the leaders of the Sudan Armed Forces and the leaders of the Rapid Support Forces. Basically, what they are doing today, none of them is fighting to support a Sudan. They are basically fighting, in my opinion, in the way I've looked at it, they are basically fighting to maximize their corporate objectives, and which is to remain in power and continue to exploit the country for their own benefit. Because if these guys are actually interested in a free Sudan, in a Sudan that can develop itself and provide for its own people, they would come together and stop this fighting. It's not that difficult, in my opinion, for them to stop fighting. They just stop fighting. The reason they are continuing to fight and continue to destroy the country is because they have objectives that have nothing to do with the maximization of the benefits of the Sudanese people. Because right now, they have created a situation in which over 18 million people are starving, mostly children. And the infrastructure of the country has been destroyed, and it's going to take billions of dollars that they don't have to reconstruct the country. And so the question is, if you are a soldier and you are interested, if you are a general and you are interested in preserving peace in country, why are you fighting and killing the same people you are supposed to protect? So to answer your question, my view is that these two groups are fighting simply to maximize very narrow objectives, and those objectives have to do with the leaderships of the groups, the people who rule these groups, their own a particular interest, and not the interests of the Sudanese people.
And of course, the biggest casualties in all this is, of course, the population of the Sudanese people.
Yes, and I think one of the things that the international community has gotten wrong on this conflict is that when you read international newspapers, when you listen to international radio, all you hear is talk about these two generals and the people and their teams. Nobody is talking about the real casualties of this problem. So a lot is being, we are talking a lot about these people, but my interest here is that emphasis should be on the millions of Sudanese people who face severe food insecurity simply because these two individuals decided to go to war. Sudan is it's a country with a lot of natural resources, a country that could produce enough food to feed itself, but it continuously places itself in a position in which people are starving on a daily basis, and this is because of the opportunistic attitudes of their military governor.
Yeah.
And so what the international community needs to do is to look at what is really happening in the country with respect to the fact that whenever these wars occur, these two people are not going to suffer very much.
Yeah.
Because I really don't know what they have done, but I could bet that many of them, or that the two of them, the two leaders, probably have resources stashed somewhere in foreign locations in case the conflict is not resolved in their favor.
Yeah.
So they are not really going to suffer personally from what is going on in the country.
Yeah.
Because if they don't win, they'll simply flee the country either to the Middle East or somewhere else and live there comfortably while the rest of the people continue to suffer.
Prof, and this is where I want to focus on the issue of the international world, international community and their reaction to this versus the international community's reaction to other conflicts around the world. My guest is Professor John Mukum Mbaku, economic professor at the Weber State University in the United States. There's no doubt in my mind, Prof, that the legacy of extractionism continues in Sudan. The legacy of colonialism is fundamentally at the core of the fight between these forces. We can characterize it in many different ways, but ultimately it's about the extractionism, the idea that these places should yield whatever they have as resources to powers that are absolutely not about the Sudanese people. It is the quintessential African story. My issue is the international world and what is glaring double standards, in my opinion, with regards to the conversation about Sudan. The reasons why we have the conflict there, the hundreds of thousands of deaths, the millions of displacements, and the fact that it has shut down, save for a few journalists, in the same way that we saw the Rwandan genocide, that was also not enjoying the international acclaim, as it were, in order for people to feel an urgency to assist the people of Sudan. I mean, of Rwanda at the time, and millions of people died there in that genocide. We've got a similar thing happening in Sudan. Why is it that the international world has not jumped up? We hear that there is a conference that's going to take place in Saudi Arabia, and there's going to be fresh peace talks that are going to take place there. And again, I'm seeing old colonialist masters starting to want to have a piece of their cake in this particular situation. The Americans are going to be involved. The French are going to be involved. But interesting that negotiation will happen in Saudi Arabia. And there is that Arabian sort of component in the conflicts that are taking place in Sudan. Why is it that we haven't heard, even from African countries such as South Africa, the loudness of the displacement, the murder, and the mayhem that's happening there in order to find solutions?
I can speak to what is happening in the US and in Europe. One of the things that we have to come to grips with in Africa, especially when we talk about African issues, is that Americans and Europeans often look at international issues from a strategic point of view. And that is that if the international issue does not have any impact on their strategic interests, they are not going to pay very much attention to that particular issue. So if there's an issue around the world and American policymakers are looking at it, if that particular issue has no strategic interest to or is not strategic to American global interests, Americans would not look very favorably towards that particular issue.
Yep.
And pay very little attention to it. And that goes along with the American media, in that American media is likely to cover an issue very well if it believes that Americans, as consumers of media, would be interested in that issue. And so what has happened is that, yes, you had massacres in the DRC. You had the Rwandan massacre, genocide. And you have problems now in Sudan where thousands of people have been killed, millions displaced, millions are going to hunger. You have the situation in South Sudan. And the international community is not paying any attention. No offense to what is happening in the Middle East, but then you have Ukraine, for example, and all of a sudden, Americans are pumping billions of dollars into Ukraine on virtually every other month. In fact, right now, Congress is planning on sending as much as $61 billion additional funding for Ukraine. And of course, the situation in Gaza, the U.S. has been supporting Israel very significantly, and Congress at the moment is planning to send a lot of money to Israel for its support. Now, you might say, why are they doing that and paying no attention to what is going on in Africa? The reason is obvious. American policymakers, no matter whether you might consider their thinking twisted, but American policymakers believe that Israel and Ukraine are more important to U.S. global interest than, for example, Sudan. It is true that Sudan signed the Abraham Accords, which were designed by Washington to improve the relationship between Israel and the Arab countries. And so by signing the Abraham Accords, Sudan became more important in the eyes of the American policymakers than it was before.
Prof, I've run out of time, but I have a burning question to ask you. The reaction of the United States is hardly surprising to me.
Yes.
Hardly surprising to me. I want to ask you more about African countries, including mine, the Republic of South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And not only African countries, but countries in the Middle East, countries in the other. I am not surprised at all about how America is behaving in all of these situations. It is expected. But African countries, including mine, are very, very adept at being involved in conversations around what's going on in Ukraine. We had a group of African leaders go to visit Putin and Zelensky to try and find a solution for peace there. We've had the South African government putting together a crack team of legal people to go and deal with the genocide in Gaza. But there is very little movement from the rest of the globe. The American story is not surprising. It would have been surprising if they had done anything different. But talk to me about the Africans and the rest of the world in 30 seconds.
Well, I think we in Africa continue to suffer from a mentality that was imposed on us by colonialism. And that is not to look at ourselves as Africans who are willing to help each other, but to continuously look to the European countries to set the agenda for us on how we think about ourselves. I think one of your politicians there by the name of Malema, I saw him on YouTube making a statement arguing that he believes that Africans hate each other and they hate themselves because, according to him, Africans are willing to do what is necessary to please the Europeans and the Americans, but very little to help the other Africans next door who are having problems. He was talking particularly about migration across the continent.
Yeah.
Africans would be willing to accept Europeans migrating to their own countries, but will not accept Africans from other countries migrating into their own country. And I think this is part of the problem that we have in Africa, in that we African leaders tend to look to Europe, look to America. And so when problems involve situations in which the Americans are interested, Africans become more interested in those situations, much more so than they are in situations that...
I must stop because we've run out of time, but I'm hoping that soon we'll come together and have another conversation. John, Professor John Mukum Mbaku, economics professor at Weber State University in the U.S. Thank you so much for a wonderful conversation.